Okay, and for those who remember, well, our listener anyway, who remember about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had Ian Chapman, who played for the Albion forever, local boy who played for the Albion forever. He was on the show, fantastic guest. And then he happened to mention a fellow who, well, with all due respect to him, because I'm about to natter to him, AD says he doesn't remember, and that's understandable because he's probably it felt like he was only with us for 5 minutes. So here I am in my office in Goring-by-Sea, talking over to Melbourne, Australia. Welcome to the Albion Roar, David Clarkson.
That is that like a it's not like a former club champion who made such left such an impression. It's like he was here for 5 minutes. Nobody knows where he went.
It was just like a will-o'-the-wisp or a Harvey the Rabbit. It was here one moment, and was he really here or was it an apparition? Well, there is a fan called David Clarks that I'm now talking to. He says he played for the Albion about 30 years ago, so I'm going to assume it's the same bloke. To be fair, it does look like him, and he hasn't changed a bit.
Good on you. Our pleasure to be on the show. Yeah, greetings from where we used to be called Melbourne, Australia was the world's most livable city. We now have the really horrible title of being the world's most lockdown city. So just before we got on to hear you complaining about anything COVID related, it's just been it's been really bad here, to be honest. And thoughts go out to everyone. It's obviously something that nobody ever wanted to live through. It's taken its toll on many people. And being at the bottom of the world, we certainly haven't missed out on it, that's for sure, unfortunately.
Sure. Now, we were just saying what the reference there is, we're just saying that, for the past sort of 18 months or so, 2 years, AD and I have been doing the show via Zoom. I think probably everyone has, and we made the query to the directors at the radio station. Can we go back in the studio? I said, well, you can, but only one at a time. Maybe two if you're actually from the same household. So having a guest in is still verboten. Hence us doing this. I've hauled my sorry backside out of bed at 8:30 in the morning. But then having said that, it is a delight to be talking to David. So it's so, and I haven't even had my morning coffee yet. I'll stop grumbling in a minute. But David, welcome to the Raw. Let's rewind something close to 30 years. Tell us about your background in football and ultimately how it came to be that you ended up at Brighton and Hove Albion.
30 years out, that's incredible. Honestly, I'm not just saying this, it really feels like yesterday. And we can talk about it more, but it was a really special time in not just my football career, but personally as well, because I really loved my time there with the people and obviously the city. And I was living in Shoreham by the sea. It was a great spot. But the way, look, my parents were 10-pound Poms out, so they immigrated to Australia in. They left Preston in the UK in 1968, and they got a train down to London. And they got a small plane over, and we arrived Boxing Day in 1969, but not to mainland Australia. For the listeners that don't know Australia well, there's a little island off the bottom of Australia called Tasmania, and whilst it's an island, it's still a state of Australia. So my uncle had actually emigrated there earlier on. So my parents, he sent a telegram or whatever he did, and they packed up myself and my sister, and as very young parents emigrated to Tassie, and I grew up there, and football was always a big part of my life. My dad was involved at the local Italian football club in Hobart, and I was always around football. He then became a referee, and I played junior football in Hobart, and then I was selected to go to. And it's funny, Chappers spoke about it, like Lillishaw. He went there as a young player, and I went to a similar place in Canberra, which is the capital of Australia, called the Australian Institute of Sport, on a 2-year football scholarship. And from there, I got my grounding as a young player, as a 15-year-old, and then I went on to play some games in what then was called the National Soccer League, which is the top competition in the country, as a young player. And I was playing for a team, funnily enough, called Sunshine George Cross. And there's a and by the way, Sunshine the suburb is not like you would the Snob Beach.
No.
And a friend of mine had actually been to the UK. He was a goalkeeper, and he had an agent there by the name of Don Packham. I can't believe I remember that guy's name. And my mate said, listen, there's an opportunity here, you should come. So I went over and I had an uncle and aunt and I stayed with them in Chorley. Do you know Chorley?
Not far from your hometown, actually, then, is it?
No, very close. Well, yeah. Leyland is where my parents' house was.
Right.
And I actually, before I came to Brighton, I was at Newcastle United for 6 months.
You kept that quiet.
And I played in the reserves. I think Willie McFaul was the manager at the time. And I played in the reserves. They never signed me. That was another club. It's funny, my timing was going through a lot of turmoil. Paul Gascoigne was there. In fact, I played in midfield with Gazza because he was coming back from an injury. And they sold him. But they never signed me. But then I think somebody from the Albion spotted me in one of the games. And then my agent took me there. And they didn't sign me straight away. Barry Lloyd was obviously the gaffer. And I think I was there a week as a 21-year-old and they offered me it might have been a 2-year deal. I think, I can't remember, but at least 1-year deal as a first-year pro. So, and I remember Al going, because I always, having the English heritage, I wanted to play in the UK. Like,
sure.
I used to... We would get match of the day with Jimmy Hill in Tasmania and I'd listen to the football scores from the first division right down to the Scottish third division. I didn't even know the teams yet. And I'd read the Shoot magazine and my dad went to the UK one time and bought me these football boots at Kevin Keegan Patrick's and I was in heaven. So I remember sitting in the car park at the Goldstone after my agent, because I didn't go in to do the deal. I was sitting in the car waiting and he came out and he said, they've signed me. And I just remember bursting into tears. It was like, oh, just the most. I seriously get goosebumps now thinking about that moment, because it was like, at that time, there wasn't a lot of Aussies playing anywhere in Europe.
No.
I was almost a trailblazer. It was a really special time.
Fantastic. So, I mean, was it a case of the Albion were looking at you and thought, well, we'll sign you, or was it... Did you have designs on any, was it any English football club would have done, even, or even a second division one?
Oh yeah, Liverpool.
Well, yeah, fair enough. And what did they say to you?
Well, they had Craig Johnson. And I thought, I can follow in his footsteps.
Yeah.
No,
it's interesting. No, you say about Australian trailblazing. Like I say, is limited, isn't it?
Well, it is really in the UK. I mean, if you look back, Craig was obviously had an incredible career at Liverpool. And then probably after him, I mean, there wasn't Mark Bosnich had a great career at Man United as a goalkeeper. And then some came, after that. But certainly at that, I mean, we're talking, when did I sign for the Albion? Actually, when I signed out, you can fill in the gaps here. It was the year we got to the playoffs for Wembley in 91.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Because you had to work.
So I don't know. I think I signed just after that or maybe before, because I've still got a tracksuit. I think it's a Ribeiro. I remember it's like a silky parachute, horrible looking thing. But it had Wembley 91 on it.
So in that case, it would be 91, 92.
Yeah, I think
I'm looking at the moment, as we're talking.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the Albion lineup. I've got, for those who know this, Tim Carter's book, The History of the Albion, which sadly only goes up to 1993. But yes, there is the squad photo of the 91-92, and that was the one that, and we talked about this just before we started, of wearing probably arguably well two of the worst kits ever. So we'll talk about that in a second. But what I would say is that tell us about the Brighton and Hove Albion that you joined. What was the culture there like?
What was the culture? I mean, obviously, the club had quite a lot of history. I was at 85 FA Cup and Steve Foster with the headband. And, it wasn't like we didn't know in Australia about Brighton and Hove Albion. What I did know about the club was that it probably was not fulfilling its potential of where it perhaps should be. And when I joined... obviously not making promotion. So that L would have been promotion into the old first division, right? Like what is now the Premier League. So then I joined and we played in the first division. And You know, I'll talk about the facilities to begin with. The old Goldstone ground, you know, it was nothing special, the change rooms. And I can't remember, but we used to drive to the ground. The club gave me this Rover car. It was quite nice, actually. And I'd drive to the ground. I mean, it was like Maroon. You know, I can't remember what happened yesterday, but I remember things like that. And we park at the ground in the car park there.
Yeah.
And then we get on, like, on a minibus. Did we go to, it's like the university maybe or somewhere?
Yeah, sounds about right. I mean, I think the clubs use several sites around the edge of the town. Usually either council or university owned. I mean, it's only now.
Yeah, I think
it's only nowadays they've got their own training facilities.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we used to drive there, and all I remember, there was like the change room facilities, nothing like quite old, no like sports science or. I can't remember the physio name. I remember Chappell's mentioning.
You'd be talking about Mike Yaxley.
No, it wasn't him.
So after that would be Malcolm Stewart.
Yes, Malcolm Stewart.
Now, Malcolm's been a guest on this show many times. So I should actually ask him about you before we came on air.
Yeah, so Malcolm, you know, he just had his room there and then we trained down on the ground. I just remember the first few sessions. I hated it because it was freezing cold. I couldn't feel my boots, my clothes in my boots. My fingers were freezing. There was people wanting to kick lumps out of me. Who's this little blonde shite that's come from Australia? Do they even play football there? So, look, I really had to earn my stripes. And I remember I was training more with a youth team. It was Stuart Mundy, I think, some few Irish boys, the boy that's passed away, not with us anymore. Paul McCarthy, which is really sad.
Yes.
And I remember Larry May out.
Yeah.
Larry May, he set up this, well, it wasn't a drill, it was more like put him in the Coliseum there and just kick lumps out of him. And then all the boys were around, it was like keep you off here, and I was against two. But the thing is, against one player. But the thing is, you know, you could bounce the ball off the outside, but the other player got to go out, and I had to stay in the whole time.
It makes as though you sound as though you were picked on in your first few training sessions.
Absolutely. You know, now, and nowadays, you know, I would have taken that to HR and it'd be known as bullying. But what it did show, though, they wanted to test my resilience, you know, and I was coming from another planet, really, and I did. And once, to be fair, once I got my contract and I started training with the first team, everything changed. And, you know, we had some really top, top pros and good people like Dean Wilkins and Clive Walker and Gary Chivers, Nicky Bissett. I used to drive to training when I first got him. Just an absolute gentleman. He'd have me around to his house with his family and, you know, for dinner. Like really top people. Mike Small was there and John Byrne.
Sure.
So good pros, you know. But more importantly to me, they were really top people who really embraced me. And Martin Hinshelwood, you know, he was really good with me. You'd have to ask him, but I think he really rated me as a player and he really wanted me to get to take every opportunity that I got. And I did get a few opportunities, so I was fortunate.
It's funny you should mention that. We had Martin Hinshelwood on the show at the beginning of the year and I was talking about his training time there and actually did actually name drop yourself as well. So it's not just Chappers that's remembered you. So,
he was good.
For such a fleeting, what became a fleeting career, you're clearly well remembered, David, so don't worry about that. So let's move on to the time you did make your debut, which was a substitute appearance at Roker Park. That's a baptism of fire, isn't it?
I think there was 13,500 there. And honestly, I don't know what minute I came on. It was probably the 70th or something. I had 20 minutes. But I was warming up, and, you know, the pitch was obviously close to the to the supporters, and we're wearing that really bad kit that you speak of, that away kit that it looked like it was somebody had got a paintbrush and slapped it. But the thing is, from a distance, it looked pink. Well, that just there I am with this white blonde hair wearing this pink ugly kit. What do you think they're going to do, those Geordies? Like, it was just I was a lamb to the slaughter. And I remember the gaffer goes, go warm up.
So don't call them Geordies, though. Sorry, David, don't call them Geordies. They'll get upset about that.
Oh, what are they?
They're Mackems.
Okay, well, the next door to the Geordies.
In that case, mate, if you want to insult them, by all means, we'll stick with Geordies.
I do, because they bloody insulted me enough, so I got my time back. So the gaffer goes, go warm up. I went out of the dugout. I ran down towards the corner flag, and I just got bombarded with all sorts. And I ran back. I got in the dugout. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm ready to go, boss.
I've just got this vision of this sort of, you know, this Chewits rapper, this big, plus this big fluffy blonde hair. I mean, I've just got this sort of a substitute candy floss stick, basically.
Well, it was me and John Byrne. He had the white hair and the blonde hair as well.
So you were his mini me.
Yeah, like that. Or he drove a convertible and I didn't. And he earned a lot more money than I did. But I remember going on the pitch. I don't know. I think we lost 3-1 or something. I don't remember the score when I went on. But I can honestly...
We lost 4-2. Was it 4-2?
Yeah, there you go. I can honestly say that I was on the pitch thinking, what am I doing here? Felt that completely out of my depth. I don't know how many touches I got. It wouldn't have been many. But, you know, after you play that, that was a baptism of fire and it taught me a lot. So from then I felt comfortable, you know, because they trusted me to put me on. So,
sure. I mean, like I say, you're this is the thing I'd say about it. And my good friend Charlie, I've been going to the Albion with for 40 years. We remember you so clearly. And yet your entire Albion career was 4 starts and 9 substitute appearances. There were other non-playing. So there was times you were on the bench and you didn't get on.
Yeah.
But the thing was I recall is... Sorry?
Was it 2 subs back then, Al? Was it only 2 substitutes back then?
It was either 1 or 2, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 2.
But the thing I recall about you, especially for those who don't remember you, well, actually, you say, how would you describe your playing style? What did you bring to the team?
Well, I can tell you something that might resonate. Because when I played in Australia, I played for a team called South Melbourne who were very successful. And our manager was Ange Postecoglou, who's now the boss of Celtic.
Okay.
Okay, so I would play as like that holding midfielder. And people would say, because we were very successful, and they would say, Clarkie, what does Ange say to you? And what are his instructions to you? And he denies this, but it's true. He would say, Clarkie, I want you to go and get the ball and then give it to the good players. So I think for me, I brought energy. You know, I was fortunate with the Albion because, it wasn't really Barry Lloyd. It was more Martin allowed me sort of freedom to get forward as well, so I could make some forward runs. And I could just cover the ground, even on those heavy pitches against, you know, big lads. I could get box to box. So I brought that energy. I like to think I brought a bit of technique and enthusiasm and willingness for the contest because I had it losing.
Sure. So in the 91-92 season, which is the one and only season you were with us, that for us, well, certainly historically, we get to realise was the start of the rumblings off the pitch. Yeah. With what ultimately culminated in the ground being sold behind our backs, under our feet, and the stuff that kicked off 2-3 years later.
Yeah.
Were you, even as someone who had come in from Australia, were you sort of aware of anything going on off the pitch that was not necessarily to the benefit of the club?
Well, you know, I know you asked Chappers that question. He'd been at the club a lot longer than I had. So, look, you know there's change room talk, so you get wind of it. But for me, I didn't want to get involved with that. I was just loving being part of the team, you know. But I guess I sensed it a little bit because, you know, the deal they offered me was £300. I got £300. They gave me 3 months of 3 months accommodation at Insurum and this car to use. And I remember also there was a church near the Goldstone that we used to train at, and it was an old dilapidated church. So when the weather was too bad, we'd go into this church. It didn't have any pews in it or anything, and the windows were broken. And we used to play
it's 5. Still there?
Is it really?
Yeah.
Be worth a fortune. And we used to go in there, and I thought, wow, they're obviously not spending money on facilities, but.
That's one way of putting it.
Well, I can get to the part where I spoke to Barry later, but you know, during that season, there was some really, there's some really fantastic moments, even though we were struggling, you know. We signed a few new players. Mark Gall, I think, came in, and there was a couple of others came in. So that it was like they were trying to get us out of the mess, but we're just falling deeper and deeper into the relegation zone.
Sure.
So we got relegated that year, yeah. So, yeah.
After Barry did promise, to be fair, Barry did promise to take us out of that division.
Yeah. Look, yeah,
wrong end.
Yeah, that's right. I remember we played, because we got on a bad, not a bad FA Cup run, and we played Crawley Town at home. Now, I don't know if you remember that game. It was full up.
I was just about to say that game. That was your first start.
Yeah, full start. That was the third round of the cup. And Chappers spoke about this. It's when he started to replace Dino. And I started to replace Robert Codner.
Oh, not particularly big boots to fill then.
Yeah, so how do you reckon that went down?
Well, quite.
Yeah, quite. So Codner, he was not happy. But it was okay. I think he was looking for a move anyway. But I remember that game. I think we might have won 5-0, and Chappers spoke. Because we just got on well in midfield. You know, we worked well together. Yeah. We'd get forward. And I remember one goal that he scored. I'd made this forward run, and I was just waiting for him to play me in, and he's hit this absolute bomb from about 30 yards off the underside of the crossbar. I don't know.
Yep.
It was my, and I was like, the boys are all around him, and then we're running back to the centre circle. I said, "You greedy bastard! You could have played me in."
Yeah. Well, I was actually convinced, and for those who heard the show. Recall this. I was convinced that he'd actually scored a hat trick. He said, "No, I only got two." And I had to look into him. Oh, you did only score two. I was convinced he'd
scored. I thought he scored three out. Was it two or three?
Yeah, no, he scored two. I actually gave him credit for three.
There were two good ones, though.
Yes.
Did John Robertson score? Did Robbo score as well? I can't remember.
I'd have to look that up. Hang on a sec. Right, pause there. It's all right.
So, what happened that year? I think then Robbo went to Charlton Athletic.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. John Byrne went on a big money move to Sunderland.
Yep. And actually, that year, John Byrne won the player of the year, but the club wouldn't give it to him because he was no longer a Brighton player.
Oh, did they?
It was a kind of a protest vote about it.
Did they make the FA Cup final that season?
Yes, Sunderland? They did. Yeah.
Mm.
Mark Gould, Clive Walker, and Raphael Mead scored the other goals in that Crawley game.
Oh, Raphael Mead. Yeah, there you go. That was a great day, I remember.
What I would say is that on your league debut or your first league start was the following week at home to Barnsley. And yes, Robbo scored that day. It was a 3-1 win. Robbo scored, Brian Wade and Chappers again. But it's interesting you're saying about your midfield partnership now then and replacing Wilkins and Codner. Even on a temporary basis, yes, it would have been it would have created waves. But I think that's the point of what was trying to be made is that Codner and Wilkins brought something to the team, but you and Chappers kind of brought something else, a bit more drive and a bit more energy. And I think that's what people appreciated. And it's interesting you're saying just now that you said, well, Barry gave you freedom, then you corrected yourself and Martin gave you freedom. So that kind of implies that there was a bit more influence that Martin Henshelwood had around the training ground and the tactics that Barry Lloyd had. Was that the case?
Well, all I can say, and it's only from what I saw, well, actually what I didn't see, I never saw Barry Lloyd. I don't think I ever saw him at training.
Yeah.
Really, I only ever see him on match day. And he spoke very little to me. In fact, it was difficult because what would happen on match day, you would go to the stadium, you didn't know if you were playing. I think you'd name a squad of 16. Mm. And then you'd go into the change rooms an hour before kickoff, and the apprentices would put, because you didn't even know what number you were. I think I wore 10 and 11 most of the time.
Yeah.
But they would put your boots. If you were playing, your boots would be under where the kid is. So you'd go in, you'd waltz in and you'd look, see if your boots are there. If not, you turn around and go back to the players' lounge and have a couple of pints, you know. And I very rarely spoke to him. In fact, the one thing And I'm not saying I didn't like him, I just didn't get to know him. But one thing he did say to me, and I'll tell you that later, that when I go to sleep at night, it still resonates in my head. We were, I don't know where we were playing, might have been Home and Away, and growing up in Australia where the grounds were very hard and we very rarely wore the screw-in studs on the boot. And at half time, because during the first half, I was slipping over. And came in at half time and his face was red and he looked at me and he said, "Can I swear?"
Please don't. We'll get the gist of it.
"Get those effing slippers off your feet."
Yeah.
Right? And that was basically, yeah, I've had very little to do with him. It was more Martin and Larry that did the majority of the coaching. And then obviously, really? Yeah.
So of all things that Barry Lloyd, manager with us for about a good sort of 6-7 years, ever said to you was, "Get those slippers off."
Yeah, I'm curious, but more than that, and he'd probably say that's not true. But, you know, that's something that stuck out in my head. But, yeah, later when I was thinking about, well, coming back, but we can go into that. So, yeah, that was that season, and I learned a lot. And
Something Barry did bring to the club that particular year was, and let's put it this way, everyone else is actually pointing the finger at him, was the actual kit itself. Blue and white stripes, absolutely. Tradition has been with the club for probably about all but 20 years of its existence. And then the blue and white striped shorts as well. Now, you mentioned the Chewit wrapper away kit, but you must have been delighted to be dressed as Andy Pandy as well at home.
Yeah, it was pretty bad here, really, wasn't it? But again, I was proud to put it on, to be honest. Not so much the shorts, but, you know, for a young boy from Australia to be in the change room with those, you know, really good pros, and whilst the Goulston ground had, you know, had seen its best days, it still created a great atmosphere. Was that the North End? Yeah. And, you know, when we'd run out for the warm up, I think the fans would sing the Neighbours theme tune to me. And
I don't remember that. I'll take your word for it, but I don't remember that.
that was really nice. I enjoyed, you know, and even walking around the town, people were very friendly and, yeah.
Fair enough. So how come your tenure here was so short? I mean, David, what happened?
Yeah, they offered me another deal on the same money for another year or two, because I came back to Australia after the season finished, and my wife at the time we had our first child in Brighton.
Yeah.
Yeah, can't remember what hospital. Then we went back and the rumblings were there that things weren't good. And my agent apparently there was interest because I think, well, Wolves in our league at that time, did we play at
very
the Molyneux?
Probably,
Molyneux and Middlesbrough were another one that was, there was definitely some interest. In fact, I got a phone call out of the blue and I thought it was someone taking a mickey. So I came back to Australia and my wife, she didn't want to come back to the UK. Now, that's the truth. And I remember, Al, credit to Barry, you know, back in the day, it was no mobile phones or anything like that. He called me at home and he said, "We really want you to come back." You know, he said, "You've done the hard work. You've laid the foundation. You're going to play, you know, you'll probably be a starter in the team." And I said, "Gaffer, I want to come back, but for my personal situation, you know, it's not going to allow it." And he said to me, and this is what rings in my ears, he goes, "Son," he goes, "once that window closes, it will close, and it's the biggest mistake that you ever make from a professional point of view."
Mm-hmm.
And he was right, Al, because that window did close. And whilst I didn't overly pursue it, you know, you soon become, clubs move on. That's just how it is. And
it was,
you know, I went on to have a half decent career, but that moment, that one moment right there changed the course of everything. And I live with that thinking, wow, what could have been? I really do.
Because, I mean, if you fast forward to nowadays, if that was your situation now,
yeah.
At the very least, you've got a reasonable professional Australian league to go back to. But in those days, that wasn't really an option, was it? There wasn't there.
Not really. It was a part-time league, you know, and then I had a young family, and then you sort of start chasing money a bit. So I went to Asia, which wasn't a bad thing. In fact, Mark Barham came to Asia while I was there. And that was in Hong Kong. I had 3 years there. So whilst the money was good, that, yeah, it was on the downward trajectory at that point.
Oh, I can see this now, even nearly 30 years on. I can see it really sort of, sorry, I think I've hit a raw nerve. I apologise if I have, but, you know, that seems, even now it seems to have hit a, you know, a real sort of, you know, moment within you.
Yeah, it has, and it does. And I don't live in the past, and it doesn't stop me functioning. But when only my close friends really know the story. And like I said, people wouldn't know why I didn't come back. That's the reason. And it was to this day the biggest professional mistake I've made.
Sure,
definitely. Yeah.
So moving on from that quote mistake, tell us about the rest of your career. Your playing career before you hung up?
Yeah, well, then I played in Asia for South China, which is the biggest club in Hong Kong. And look, that was good. I played for the Hong Kong national team as a foreigner. So we got to play against touring teams and big tournaments, played against AC Milan with Baresi, Donadoni, Maldini, you know, Van Basten, Hullet at Hong Kong Stadium, 70,000 people. So I still had moments.
I'll say, did you see the ball that day?
No, I didn't. My dad found a video. Funnily enough, I did touch it a few times. And then I came back to Australia and I signed for the biggest club in the country, South Melbourne, and I had really good success here. In fact, we went, whilst it was a semi-professional league of some really top, top players, and we went back-to-back champions. And then at the time in 2000, there was a competition called the World Club Championships, which was an inaugural year in 2000. So the best eight club teams from around all the world would represent their confederation. So we represented Oceania at the time, which we were part of that confederation. So we went to Brazil and played at the Maracanã in front of 80,000 people against, we played, well, in our group was Vasco da Gama, Man United, Beckham's goals.
And is this a team tournament that Man United were playing in that they had to dip out of the FA Cup?
Well done, Al. Well done. You know your stuff. That's exactly what happened. And that in fact, because they won the Champions League final, Solskjaer, against Bayern Munich 3-2 in the 99. Then they came to Brazil in 2000. They didn't want to be there because they had to drop out of the FA Cup. So they were not really interested. It was an incredible tournament. And then I played 200-odd games with South Melbourne. Then I went into some coaching and administration, and I actually travelled with the current Celtic boss, Ange, with the young national teams, the under-17s and the 20s, as his assistant coach. We did two World Cups together. Mm-hmm. And now I'm a football ambassador in the community space with community football clubs for a team that's in now the professional league in Australia, in the A-League, called Western United Football Club. So I'm still involved with the game. I've been fortunate. I don't really know anything else, so... you know, I'm still very much hands-on, and I keep abreast of what's going on with the Albion and all leagues across the world, really.
Well, we'll come to that in a second, but it just then, if I'm going to touch a nerve earlier, I'm going to do it again. If a call came in from England or even from the current Celtic manager to say, Dave, do you want to get your backside over here? What would be your response now?
What time do I leave? Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm fortunate. I still have my British passport, and I think one of my other small regrets is never really keeping in touch with, you know, the people. I know the club's changed over the journey, over the years, but I haven't really kept a connection apart from watching. And although we have a Seagulls Down Under club here that Steve runs in New Sydney, which
Steve
is really
very brilliantly, yes.
Yeah, and obviously we've had some, you know, Aussie players that have done well at Albion. Paul Reid did well at Albion. Ali Edwards played there. Obviously, Aaron Moy and Matty Ryan. So, you know, there's an Australian connection right, you know, back from when I started.
Do you actually have you actually talking of the Seagulls Down Under? Have you been invited to get involved in when the Robert Eaton Memorial Fund games are played down there?
Yeah, I did, and I don't know what happened. I can't remember, but I do keep in touch with Steve. But COVID's killed us a bit, and some things that he was going to do just didn't happen. Right. So I can't remember what happened there.
Well, here's to anyone who lives in Australia and New Zealand that wants to get involved, because what Steve runs down there is fantastic. And like I say, keeping in touch with the old players who are either Australian or play in Australia.
And I must say, Al, there's another big connection. I was mentioning it to you before, and people would remember this name, Rob Shaw, who wrote for the Argus, covered all the Albion games,
yeah.
Who knows everything about every Albion player. And, you know, I kept in touch after I left Albion and I came back to Australia. We kept in, well, he introduced himself. I never met him in the UK. And we used to touch base and different things that we were doing, and he's writing still about football, and, you know, he would do stuff on my career. And Western United, my team played, he lives in Launceston in Tassie, and we played a couple of games down there last season. And it was for the first time I'd ever met Rob Shaw. We went to a pub in town, and he brought along with him just a big booklet of all the old programs, and he had one from me on my birthday on where I was on the front cover. I can't remember who it was against when we played at home. It was just, it was really, really nice to meet him. And I realised at that time that we probably lack it here in Australia, but, you know, how much clubs mean to people. Like, it's part of his DNA, and wherever he lives, or it's still very much, you know, with him, which is nice.
Well, when you have that point about, you know, supporting a given club, if it's your hometown, for instance, and it's a hometown that's got a professional football team in, you tend to follow it. And there's like a kind of a social unwritten law that you choose your team, you stay with it. Now, there are people who sort of, you know, for whatever reasons may move on. You know, there's a good friend of ours, Andy, who was at West Ham, got fed up with the way it was being run and came and helped us in our battles 25 years ago. Then there's the football fan who will come and support Liverpool or Man United or Chelsea just because they're the biggest side. Now, that's what happens with a society in England. But when you're in Australia and you've got to choose a professional side to support, it's like it when we've got fans now in the Premier League, we've got fans in America, we've got fans all over the place who arbitrarily choose a team. And it's a bit like, I suppose, British people choosing an A-League team, or certainly probably more likely an NFL team to support, or even a foreign team to support. So over there in Australia, like I say, you mentioned Seagulls Down Under, but that's mostly for expats. So are you aware of sort of, you know, Australians, certainly around Melbourne? And I think there's a suburb of Melbourne called Brighton, isn't there? So...
So
is there a kind of a swell at all of Australians, or certainly of people in Melbourne looking to support the Albion now that we're kind of, you know, on that international spotlight?
No, I have to say no. I think what you said there is, it's got to be a connection. I remember I went to one like football clinic in Launceston, and there's this young boy, he had the Albion shirt on. I'm like, wow. And it was because his dad, you know, was a supporter back in the day.
Yeah.
So, you know, you go to a lot of these, you know, school clinics or whatever they might be, and kids are, like you said, they wear Man United or Chelsea or Liverpool, or you might see the odd one, but, you know, I'll tell you this. Brighton Soccer Club, who are the biggest community football club in Victoria with over 1,400 members, they were historically green and yellow. But somebody on the committee had a connection with Brighton in the UK or was a Seagull supporter. They now, and it probably only happened, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, not even, they now wear the blue and white stripes.
Absolutely. Hallelujah.
All of their kids. This Brighton Soccer Club wear the blue and white. So there you go. That's...
I was about to say, maybe, I mean, obviously, you know, Brighton being a different football club, but even with Western United, maybe there ought to be a role for you as an ambassador for Brighton and Hove Albion across Melbourne and across Victoria, because, you know, if you're saying it's not happening down there yet, you know, there's a role for you there, mate, I think.
Well, and I mean, obviously not so much me or even Paul Reed to that, but certainly Aaron Moy and Matty Ryan made a big impression, you know, yes. Current players as Seagulls players. So, I mean, people obviously know about the album. There's no doubt about that.
Fair enough. Now, there's one big story that obviously came out from Australia in the past couple of months. And it's something that we've talked about on this show before. We've had Louise Englefield from Football v Homophobia on before. Now, finally, and it's kind of, there's such an anathema, this notion, is that we had a professional male footballer come out as gay, Josh Cavallo, who plays for Adelaide United.
That's right.
He's actually just come out and said, you know, I think probably with a, you know, with a certain sense of trepidation, but also a certain sense of, well, up your society to those who don't like it, that I am gay. Yeah. And obviously everyone within decent society supports what he's doing. And there is the notion of, well, you know, why is his sexuality so important? And you think, well, actually, under the great scheme of things, it probably isn't, until such time as, you know, it's accepted within the norm of the society in which football operates. Now, we have our sort of reaction here. Obviously, it's been mostly supportive towards Josh, but what's it been like in Australia?
Well, it's been incredibly supportive, actually. You know, and good on Josh. Funnily enough, Al, I did some mentoring and player agency, and I don't know, it was quite a few years ago now. I took this young player, Andy Brennan, he's a Tasmanian kid, to Newcastle Jets, who play in the A-League here in Australia in a professional competition, and they signed him on a 2-year deal. Well, and I didn't know any of this, and I know Andy really well. Probably about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, he came out as a gay footballer, and it came to the UK, but he wasn't playing professionally at the time. He was playing as a semi-pro.
Right, yeah.
So I was his agent. And then, funnily enough, Josh Carvello's brother, I took him to Denmark for 2 weeks.
Right.
But he didn't come out as gay, but it was all of a sudden I'm, you know, have this connection of, and then I saw Josh come out as gay. Going back to your questions, it's been incredibly well accepted. But you know the nice thing out, like to see Josh when he's interviewed, to just see the, I guess, relief, and it's almost like the stress has been completely removed from his body. And I think he would have been anxious about the reaction that he was going to receive. But look, and not that this means anything, I think he had 10,000 followers on his Instagram account. That it's like 150,000 now. So that shows you the sort of support that he's getting. And the PFA here in Australia and the Australian Professional Leagues have supported him. And the game itself has supported him. But, you know, as we've seen, there's clubs, big clubs, Barcelona, Real Madrid, big individuals that have come out and said, you know, Van Persie, well done, Josh, you know, you should be proud. So,
absolutely.
And I'm sure there'll be some that don't agree, but I think on the whole, yeah.
Well, I think this is, I think the vast, certainly of Brighton fans, the vast majority, if any player comes out, I don't think he's going to have to be a player, one of your own players, but if any given player comes out, I'd like to think that, you know, the vast majority of people would be, you know, openly supportive, and to the point that eventually someone coming out is as interesting as, you know, the fact they had a cheese sandwich for their lunch, you know, that it eventually becomes a non-story, you know, and it's in so many facets and aspects of life. And I'm talking of politics, the arts, you know, it's not an issue. And yet, and not even just sport, it's men's sport, and more specifically men's football.
Yeah.
It's absolutely so bizarre that it's still an issue.
Yeah, I think the game's moved on so much, but there's still part of us that, you know, there's still that macho for the male on the terraces, you know, the drinking of the beer. And look, I don't know what it's like in the UK, but certainly in Australia with racism, that's we're really confronting that. Well, pushing hard to get rid of racism in the community, not just in sport, but, you know, with our Indigenous people. And it's, you know, the thing is now, Al, it's not swept under the carpet or hidden, you know, anymore. It's out. People are discussing it. And there's going to be different opinions, obviously, but it's being discussed. So, yeah, that's
sure.
A good
thing. Sure. Okay, David, listen, we're getting to the end of this now, but just as a final sign-off, like I say, your tenure here was all too brief, and notwithstanding what you see as a kind of historic mistake in your life, but you know that oh-so-brief time at the Albion, what did it mean to you? How did it affect who you are?
Oh, gee. Again, when I think back at my time there as a professional, I have nothing but fond memories. You know, even though we were struggling, we had to train in a church. And that to me was it was a great grounding as well to say, well, not everything's, you know, laid out red carpet type stuff. And it was hard to get a deal, you know, it wasn't handed to me. I just have really fond memories of the players. Like when I heard Chappers speak, it felt like yesterday. You know, I know everyone's moved on, and it's nice that some people remember me, but I remember those people like Nicky Bissett and those guys, and like it really is like yesterday. And the people at the club, they're in the backroom staff, Jock, who was the kit manager, you know, just solidly with people that would do anything for you. And it helped me become a decent footballer, but I could have taken a path that would have led me to a different place that, you know, unfortunately that didn't happen.
Well, David Clarkson, one, don't forget where you got friends over here, so do come over and see us as soon as you can. But two, thanks very much indeed for coming onto the Albion Raw.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. All the best to all the Albion fans. I appreciate it.